From Los Angeles, California, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Tuesday, March 15th, 2016. Activists push back against Donald Trump and his supporters. We'll turn to Arun Gupta for what the clashes in Chicago last Friday mean for the rest of the election. And are the states of Texas and Indiana returning us to the age of the coat hanger? Jessica Piclo of RH Reality Check will give us the lowdown on the landscape of anti-abortion regulations. Plus, a former nuclear engineer spends a month in Japan on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. We'll speak with Arnie Gunderson about the reality on the ground. That's coming up after the news. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Activists in Chicago disrupted a planned rally for Donald Trump at the University of Illinois at Chicago last Friday. The rally was to take place at the UIC Pavilion, but as an organized group of anti-Trump activists descended, clashes broke out inside and outside the location, leading Trump to cancel. It appears as though the activists who organized the disruption were a combination of UIC students, Black Lives Matter, and other Chicagoans. According to reports, protesters outnumbered supporters by at least a 5-to-1 ratio. There were conflicting reports about whether Trump would cancel his planned rally in Cincinnati ahead of Tuesday's primary races. My guest is Arun Gupta. He's an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He's a frequent guest on Uprising. Welcome back to the show, Arun.
Thanks for having me on, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, were you surprised at what happened in Chicago, especially given that at rally after rally, there have been small numbers of people entering Trump's events and, of course, been kicked out often violently? Was Chicago sort of a natural outcome of that, or was it kind of shocking?
It did come as a surprise. I don't think anyone could say they really expected Trump would cancel the event. I think one important thing to right off the bat is that the protesters did not physically shut this down or violate his free speech as liberals are wringing their hands right now. They were going to be there to disrupt it, to raise their voice. They weren't there to be violent. It was Trump who shut this down. So his free speech was never violated. He did not want to be embarrassed because there were such a huge crowd of protesters inside the auditorium.
That's a very good point. So he is now going to be speaking at some major rallies. And as he attempts to make his, address his supporters, it seems as though a lot of people might be trying to look at Chicago as a model for how to greet Trump in their cities. Should it be seen as a good model?
I think it could be seen as a model, but we need to recognize that there are always particularities, and Chicago has a lot of them in this case. For one, this was on a college campus that is heavily people of color, and this demonstration was very much people of color led. There were, of course, African-American, Black Lives Matter activists. There were Muslim Americans, Students for Justice in Palestine, many Latino Hispanic activists as well. Traditionally, this is also a working class college, the one that we're talking about. So I think Trump will not make the mistake of going someplace that's going to clearly be hostile to him again. And also the activists us were able to put the Chicago Police Department on the defensive because there's been just such tremendous organizing against them for so long. You know, we saw then a day or so later, protesters in Kansas City were attacked by police there with pepper spray, and the police chief was praising it as preventing a riot, which is ludicrous because virtually the only violence is coming from the Trump security and their supporters. So, you know, I think if we wanted to talk more about exactly what went on, I wasn't there, but I've been following it very closely, we can talk about why it worked.
Now, there was even ahead of the Chicago event, there was a really nasty incident between a Trump supporter and a protester in North Carolina. And this man punched a protester multiple times. He has also been he's basically somebody who made threats. You know, there've been talk about killing protesters and you know knocking them out. And of course, Trump has encouraged this very clearly in his rallies. Right, there was a montage of video clips that someone made of him saying, get him out," and he repeatedly has been saying this at every rally he's at. Get rid of them, get them out of here, kick him out. How responsible should he be held for the violence that his supporters subject protesters to?
Oh, I think very much so. You know, it's not just what you say is very correct, but it goes far beyond that, right, as well, where he's telling people to knock the crap out of protesters. He's telling people, oh, in the old days, they would be taken out of stretchers. We're too politically correct. There's been a number of montages made. I would recommend that folks find the one that Rachel Maddow did recently, because what's really interesting, they put together for MSNBC how he keeps linking it to, oh, we're politically correct. This is what happens when you're politically correct. And this is linked to when he's always like, oh, you know, people love me because I'm not politically correct. That what he's calling about, we need to return to this kind of era of mob violence. I mean, it's one step away essentially from calling for lynch mobs. And we're seeing, you know, people, the physical attacks, the one guy who sucker punched a protester, and then he told the news cameras, we may have to kill him next time. Trump is very much encouraging a lynch mob mentality. Now, he's had to dial it back a little, but I think this is pretty dangerous. What's going on, and we also should reject this idea that, oh, he's just unleashing forces. You know, these attitudes, this deeply held racism, the xenophobia, the nativism, all of that exists, but he's shaping it also and creating it into something very different. And I think, you know, the terms that we need to think about what he's doing are things such as extermination and eliminationism. He wants to eliminate 11 million undocumented immigrants, Mexicans especially, from public life. He wants to eliminate Muslims. And this, again, you know, it's not, we're not talking about death camps, but he is on that path. You know, you don't deport 11 million people without creating concentration camps. So this all is a very dangerous moment, I think, and it will continue to be even if he's defeated.
And we're seeing people like Ann Coulter echo him and egg him on. She just tweeted on March 13th, this is literally her quote, "I would like to see a little more violence from the innocent Trump supporters set upon by violent leftist hoodlums." This is Ann Coulter. I mean,
yeah.
There's no interpreting that any other way.
Yeah. And of course, you know, this also is something very effective that the right does. They play the victim. Fascists historically have always done this as well. They present them as the victim when they are very much the aggressor. Of course.
Yeah. And I also want to quote the sort of war of words on Twitter between Trump and Bernie Sanders, because apparently there were many people carrying Bernie Sanders signs at the Trump rally in Chicago. But this is what Trump said. Bernie Sanders is lying when he says his disruptors aren't told to go to my events. Be careful, Bernie, or my supporters will go to yours. And Sanders responded, send them. They deserve to see what an honest politician sounds like. I mean, it's escalating between the candidates themselves.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that Trump responded in that way. You know, he's very much full of bravado and bluster. But this also, I think, gets to, there's been this debate raging about, is Trump a fascist or not? And it's just like, well, he has very much set in motion a fascist movement. I think this is at the very earliest stages of what we would expect a fascist movement to look like. But when he is getting effusive praise for violent neo-Nazis from Stormfront, from the Klan, from David Duke, from all these white supremacist groups, from all these like just violent anti-immigration groups, and now we're starting to see this type of not quite open street fighting, but it has a potential for that. We are seeing very much the conditions that led to the rise of European fascism in the 1920s and 30s.
Let's also talk about the fact that he apparently now has Secret Service members protecting him. There was recently a reporter that was very violently assaulted by a member of the Secret Service. Does this now mean that any perceived threat as at a Trump rally where Trump himself is present might be seen in a similar legal light as a threat to the president? And why is Secret Service protecting him in the first place?
Well, this is standard operating procedure. When a candidate, I'm not sure what the exact criteria are, but Trump has had Secret Service protection since November. It's when you're starting to be considered that you are a leading candidate or there are a number of threats. I don't think there's anything problematic about that. And in fact, it's kind of better that I think the Secret Service be protecting him than his own Gestapo and intelligence force that he's creating. The problem, though, with the Secret Service protection is there was a change in the law a couple of years ago. Now that any event where the Secret Service is involved, it's can be considered a felony to protest.
Right.
And so, you know, we've seen, like in Chicago, I think something like 32 people were protested. I mean, what I'm hoping is that we start to see people filing civil suits against Trump and his organization. And, you know, I don't know if there's any, you know, prosecutors that are have the guts to go after him, but the man is clearly inciting mob violence. And you know, when he tells people to punch him, to knock the crap out of him, and I'll pay your legal fees, he is culpable for that violence, and we've seen all sorts of violence. So you know, it's something that really needs to be addressed much more strongly.
And I'm glad you brought up that other quote. That was literally what he said. He basically didn't even say, you know, he didn't even hold back. It was just, go after these protesters and I will pay your legal fees. I will be responsible for you financially. And essentially, he is directing, almost like if he had a paramilitary at his fingertips, he would direct them who to attack. It's just amazing. And we're seeing the polls. This interview is being done on the day of the primaries in the day before the primaries in Florida and Ohio, and the polls are showing Trump leading in the Republican field. What does this say about the Republican Party?
Well, I think, you know, there is, what does it say about America? You know, that there is this millions, perhaps even a few tens of millions of people who it's easy to just stoke this very deep racism and hatred and these violent attitudes. I think the Democrats do bear a lot of responsibility for this. The lion's share is with the right wing. They've been stoking this type of racism for well over 50 years. I would also point your listeners to the series of articles I've been doing on the campaign for Telesaur, where I explain this in much more detail.
And we'll post a link to that from our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Arun, thank you as always for joining us. We'll have you back on in the future.
Thank you, Sonali.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who has written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Telesur. This is Uprising, back in just a moment. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Much is at stake in a Supreme Court case over a Texas abortion law. The nation's highest court heard oral arguments last week in Whole Women's Health versus John Hellerstedt. The case challenges the restrictions placed on abortion clinics in Texas under a law called HB2. That law uses medical arguments to restrict women's access in a state that has already decimated most of its clinics. Increasingly, there are reports of women attempting abortions at home, an often life-risking exercise. Meanwhile, the state of Indiana just passed a draconian anti-abortion bill last week that so severely curtails abortion access that it has left reproductive rights advocates horrified. Governor Mike Pence is expected to sign it into law soon. Since 2001, there have been 471 laws and regulations passed all over the country, chipping away at women's right to an abortion. My guest is Jessica Piclo. She is the Vice President of Law and the Courts at RH Reality Check. Welcome to Uprising, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Let's first stay on Texas before we go to Indiana. Now, as I mentioned, there have already been many curtailments of women's rights in Texas, reproductive rights. This particular law, HB2, if the court lets it stand, what would the repercussions be for Texas women?
The repercussions would be huge. So at issue before the Supreme Court are a couple provisions of HB2. HB2 is what I like to call a Frankenstein's monster of anti-abortion legislation. It takes a bunch of different provisions and stitches them all together. The provisions that the Supreme Court looked at are two in particular that we call trap laws, targeted regulation on abortion providers. One requires that all abortion clinics meet the same architectural standards as standalone surgical centers, even if that clinic provides no surgical services. The second is a provision that requires all doctors who perform abortions in the state to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where the abortion is performed. And in an area like the Rio Grande Valley, that's an impossibility.
So this court now, of course, has a different makeup. The Supreme Court sans Justice Antonin Scalia is a different Supreme Court, right?
It is absolutely a different court.
And so what does that mean? I mean, is it possible for there to be deadlock 4-4?
It is very possible for there to be deadlock. And what that would mean for the case specifically is kind of up in the air because it could deadlock and go a couple different ways. Presuming the court votes 4-4, what that immediately means is that the Fifth Circuit decision stands, and the Fifth Circuit said that the rule should take effect. However, when the case got to the Supreme Court itself put a different order in that said while the litigation is ongoing, the rules should not take effect. So one of the open questions is, if the Supreme Court were to tie 4-4, would they keep that stay in place while the case reworks its way through the appellate system? Or would they lift that and let the rules take effect, which would be absolutely devastating? By our closest estimate, that could leave Texas with only 9 clinics.
Wow, an entire and a very the largest physical geographic state in the nation with only 15 clinics across it. Now, don't women have a right granted by the Supreme Court to be able to access abortion without an undue burden placed on that person seeking an abortion?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's the Constitution that grants us the right to terminate a pregnancy when we need to. And the Supreme Court has placed some limitations and restrictions on that right. And the one that you so rightly noted is that a abortion restriction cannot place an undue burden on a woman seeking to terminate a pregnancy. And the courts have really mucked up that standard in terms of what precisely constitutes an undue burden. That is a central question before the Supreme Court in Hellerstedt.
And Salon covered the opening arguments in this case and related Justice Ginsburg, who very rightly pointed out that when she argued that the law would essentially make women have to drive so far that they would in fact be better off accessing clinics across the New Mexico border, basically it was argued that, well, yes, and so, you know, if those clinics across the border in New Mexico are good enough for New Mexico women, why are they not good enough for Texas women if those restrictions being placed on those clinics in terms of the surgical requirements? And the person defending HB2 didn't have an answer to that.
I think that what that shows is the health and safety justifications for these laws are non-existent. Justice Ginsburg's point was exactly on the money. The state of Texas is arguing that there's no undue burden because if clinics close, Texas patients can just travel out of state to get an abortion. And as Justice Ginsburg noted, well, you know, that sends them one place is New Mexico, where these restrictions aren't in place. New Mexico hasn't passed anything like that. So by Texas's own standards, New Mexico does not even meet the same safety requirements, which is exactly what Justice Ginsburg pointed out. One of the things that gets lost, though, is that Texas patients have to travel east also. And if you look east on the map, that takes them to Louisiana, where the Fifth Circuit is trying to shut down clinics in that state too. Louisiana has passed an identical law that, if upheld, would leave that state with only one clinic. And you go further east and you run into Mississippi, which also has a similar law on the books and that is also keeping its only clinic in the state open by court order. So the ripple effect, should these laws be allowed to fully take effect, could leave the Deep South with maybe a handful of abortion clinics for the entire region.
Wow. Now, if the Texas restrictions are upheld by the Supreme Court, even though that seems highly unlikely without Scalia, what would the impact be across the country? Is that the opening that abortion opponents across the country are looking for to pass their own more restrictive or equally restrictive regulations?
I think that's certainly one part that we need to be paying very close attention to. 23 states right now have laws similar to Texas's on the books. And so a broad ruling endorsing these kinds of regulated or hyper-regulations on abortion providers would absolutely encourage anti-choice lawmakers in states that have not yet passed these laws to try and push them. But what we've seen is that regardless if the Supreme Court acts, with each election cycle, anti-choice conservatives are getting bolder and bolder in their legislative attacks on reproductive autonomy.
Let's turn to Indiana, Jessica. HB 1337 was approved by the legislature in Indiana last week. And we should remember Indiana is the same state that brought us the horrific case of Purvi Patel, the Indian-American woman who was was sentenced to something like 20 years in prison for so-called feticide. I mean, basically, she had a stillbirth, an early stillbirth, and she was convicted of something akin to homicide. What exactly is HB 1337 in Indiana? How does it compare to the slew of other regulations passed around the country? Is this another Frankenstein law?
It is another Frankenstein law. It's another one of these omnibus measures that contains a whole bunch of individual provisions that, when sewn together, really are targeting at making abortion legal in name only, so that it is a right on the books, but it is not a procedure that patients can effectively access. And HB 1337 has some particularly cruel provisions in them. For example, one requires that even in the case of miscarriage, a patient make arrangements for the disposal of the fetal remains. So funeral arrangements effectively for, and burial arrangements effectively for a miscarriage. When you think of the grief that a person is already going through at that process, that just strikes me as heartless. And, you know, that's in addition to provisions that mandate a patient hear the fetal heartbeat and engage in another ultrasound 18 hours before and the procedure. Those are things that just add additional cost and expense. And when you wrap all of the provisions together, what it is an effective ban on abortion, except in the most extreme circumstances.
So essentially, Indiana is going the way of Texas, or is it even worse?
It is going the way of Texas, and it's basically a race to the bottom. I mean, many of these really states that have been run for a long time by really conservative lawmakers have created a fortress of restrictions that patients need to navigate. And whether they're on the books or blocked by court order, one of the effects is to have women so confused about the process of how to access reproductive services that they don't. And we see then the alarming spike in the number of attempts by women to self-terminate pregnancies, or as you mentioned with Indiana, and this is happening in states across the country, the alarming trend to criminalize pregnancy outcomes so that women are being jailed as a result of this.
I mean, I'm thinking of some countries in Latin America that have horrifically restrictive abortion rights and have imprisoned women for things like basically having a miscarriage. It feels like we're going in that direction. It just is amazing that in the United States this is happening. I understand in Indiana that even for women who might become pregnant as a result of rape or incest, or even in the case where a mother's life might be threatened by the pregnancy, that she is forced to, or would be forced to, listen to heartbeats and have ultrasounds and all of that other stuff. I mean, that's just, what is the point of that? I mean, just, you know, if a woman's life is in danger unless her pregnancy is terminated, what is the point of having her listen to the fetal heartbeat except to basically torture her mentally?
Yeah, to punish her for having sex that they don't approve of, frankly. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Another provision in the Indiana law would force women to carry to term pregnancies that were doomed. So you would effectively be condemned to carry a stillbirth. So to the extent that conservative lawmakers are pretending that they A, care about women and children, or B, have any interest in patient safety, these measures should really put those claims to bed.
Now, Jessica, is the group of politicians that has made this such a huge issue in state after state around the country, is this group out of touch with the evangelical sort of anti-abortion faction in the country? I'm looking, for example, at the rise of the demagogue Trump, who is able to whip up the kind of frenzy that we just haven't seen in a very long time, or, you know, we've seen in fascist countries, which is kind of whip up this frenzy of conservatives. And Trump is pro-abortion. Trump has supported Planned Parenthood. Is abortion just not as huge an issue politically as some of these lawmakers think it is?
You know, that's an excellent question. I think for the couple things fall into play there. One, in an election cycle at the state level, anti-abortion restrictions are a great way to drive people to the polls and raise money. So we just have seen that. Conservatives really use this as a way to chum the waters for their base. But what I think is a disturbing trend in the anti-choice movement is its failure to condemn these most restrictive abortions or restrictions, or in the case of Purvi Patel, to stand silent as women are being put in prison. There was an even more disturbing case in Tennessee where the prosecutors tried to at first charge a woman with attempted murder as a result of her self-abortion attempt. They dropped that charge, but the anti-choice community came right out and said, good, she should be put in jail if she's trying to terminate a pregnancy on her own. And that is a vastly different change in tone from the anti-choice movement, and one that I think they should answer for.
Wow. I mean, there the image of the coat hanger from the 1960s that propelled so many feminists to become active and to take back the control over their bodies is sadly going to, I think, be more and more appropriate in this modern day and age. And who thought, you know, that we would ever see this again? I mean, and the kinds of, you know, the kinds of things that women resort to when they're desperate are horrifying. Each woman's circumstance is unique. Some women might, you know, feel like they have absolutely no choice but to use dangerous pills that they might have gotten off the internet, or I'm guessing the worst case scenario is the coat hanger in the house. I mean, I hate to bring all of this up on a morning drive time program, but frankly, I think we're not facing the realities of what women are facing. Most women are facing today, right?
Well, that's exactly what happened in Tennessee. You know, Anna Yoka tried to self-terminate a pregnancy in the bathtub with a coat hanger and was rushed to the hospital room with severe heavy bleeding. The doctors and hospital staff made the decision to deliver and save the pregnancy, and the child was born with severe injuries, pre-viability. They've kept it alive. The anti-choice movement is using this as a rallying cry, but instead, what very few people are talking about is the extreme desperation and isolation and lack of resources available to this woman that she would take such measures. Those are not the kinds of things that people with access to resources do.
Wow. Well, Jessica, where can listeners get information that you work on? Give out a website for RH Reality Check.
Sure. We are rhrealitycheck.org, and my colleagues and I track anti-choice legislation at the state and national level, from committee through the courts. We track the organizations and report on the folks who are funding this, who are promoting this, and link it not just to abortion restrictions, but to really the wide range of attacks on autonomy and choice and people's just day-to-day lives.
Well, we'll post a link to that from uprisingwithsonali.com later today. Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Piclo is the Vice President of Law and the Courts at rhrealitycheck.org. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It has been 5 years since the magnitude 9 earthquake that triggered a devastating tsunami hit Fukushima, Japan. The tsunami itself swept over towns and villages, flattening 400,000 homes and buildings and killing more than 15,000 people, making it Japan's worst peacetime disaster. Because the tsunami damaged the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, it caused a major meltdown and became the world's worst nuclear catastrophe since the 1986 Chernobyl incident. My guest is Arne Gunderson. He's just finished a one-month tour of Japan where he met with Fukushima evacuees. He sits on the board of directors of Fairwinds Energy Education. He has more than 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience. He was the recipient of a prestigious Atomic Energy Commission Fellowship for his master's degree in nuclear engineering, and he holds a nuclear safety patent. He was a licensed reactor operator and former nuclear industry senior vice president. During his nuclear power industry career, Arne Gunderson managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the United States. Welcome to Uprising, Arne.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, your bio obviously makes it seem like you know what you're talking about when it comes to nuclear reactors and how these things work. So let's talk about your tour through Japan first. How you were there for a month. Who did you meet and what sorts of conversations did you have with people?
You know, there was a lot of really sad conversations. So I met with a lot of the people who were forced to leave and are now in essentially giant trailer parks. I met with the most memorable one was I met with 22 women in a 66 trailer park. And it was amazing. We were the first people in 5 years to ever talk to them about radiation.
What? Does that include the Japanese government?
That neither the Japanese government nor Tokyo Electric ever talked to them about radiation.
Oh, my goodness.
And yet they're off their land. They're unable to ever return. And they know nothing. It was amazing. It was so sad. Lots of stories of the smells and the skin lesions they developed. And we had one woman who lost her hair. She had speckles all over her skin. She had a bloody nose, and her doctor told her it was stress, and she believed it. The inhumanity of the Japanese government toward its own people is just amazing.
What did the situation look like? Did you actually go to Fukushima?
Well, I saw it from a distance. Mm-hmm. We asked Tokyo Electric if I could come in, and they declined to respond. So I was about half a mile away at the closest. You know, the entire mountain range, there's a mountain range about 20 miles inland, sort of like the west coast of the U.S. You know, you've got a coastal plain, and then inland you've got a mountain range. And the entire mountain range is contaminated. We found radioactive wild boar. You know, a hunter had killed a wild boar, and we put a radiation detector on the meat, and it was pegging the scale. And then we found they have wild monkeys in their mountains, and one of the guys I was with followed a monkey and collected its droppings, and the droppings were astronomically radioactive. And I crawled out in a farmer's field and measured cow flop, and I had the same experience. So radiation is everywhere.
You know, it's so interesting. I was looking at a study that was just done this week, a British study. A team of experts from four British universities developed a series of tests to examine the relocations after the Fukushima crisis and see if the massive amount of expense was worth the cost in terms of how many additional months or years people's lives were extended by. And what they found was that the average lifespan was extended by about only 8 months in doing the relocation. And essentially, the group of researchers assessed that the cost of relocation and the fact that, you know, many thousands of elderly people died simply from the stress of relocation, that they said it wasn't worth it.
Yeah, I absolutely disagree with that. You know, there's for two reasons. First off, there's the fact that the cost is borne by Tokyo Electric, and the risk is borne by the 100,000 people who have to leave. So, you know, I don't see any Tokyo Electric executives bringing their people, bringing their families in for cheap real estate. But the more important thing is that all of these studies are grossly underestimating the risk. And they're using this model that's based on a 30-year-old man who was exposed to a burst of radiation from an A-bomb. And all of the models go back to that. But women and children are 20 times more radiosensitive. So even if you accept that 8-month life increase for 150,000 people, that's a lot. But then if you say, well, half of them were women and another quarter were children. So the actual life extension, if you will, to my way of thinking, is astronomical.
And also it's an average, right? So there are individuals who might get, you know, cancer when they ordinarily might not have and die earlier. And so at an individual level, the cost between, you know, dying 10, 20 years before you should from cancer versus not is pretty significant too.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, we had a lot of cases where people told us that their doctors were covering up the radiation symptoms. We had one doctor come forward and say that whenever he diagnosed a patient with a radiation-related illness, the Japanese government refused to pay his bill.
Wow.
And they put him out of business. So with that kind of pressure on the medical community, it's hard to get good epidemiological data about what these people are getting ill from.
So if you want to stay in business as a doctor, you basically have to underdiagnose or misdiagnose radiation-related illnesses. Wow.
Yes. You know, like that woman I told you, her hair is falling out, she's got a bloody nose, et cetera, and they're telling her it's stress. Oh, you know, I'm sorry, it's not. So you're absolutely right. The pressure on the medical community is astronomical to downplay the significance of this.
I was reading a part of a report that you wrote describing walls of black plastic bags containing highly toxic radioactive waste have been left in fields, along highways, and beside country roads without plans for permanent disposal. I've not heard this anywhere else. Tell us about this.
Oh, geez, it's amazing. They have 30 million bags. And these aren't the bag you take out to your trash. Each one of these bags weighs a ton. So they've got 30 million bags of radioactive material.
So in terms of soil that they kind of confiscated? Or?
Yes. Hmm. A lot of it is, they're hand scrubbing rocks and collecting the material that they get off the rocks. They're going through lawn clippings and people's roofs and stuff like that.
Also, contaminated clothes that people are using?
Mm-hmm. Contaminated clothes, contaminated biological material, whether it's, you know, trees. Some of the trees were so contaminated, they were afraid that they, in the event of a fire, they would go airborne. Oh. All that radiation would go airborne. So they just cut the trees down and ground them up, and sooner or later they're going to figure out something to do with all this radioactive material.
And so let's also talk about the fact that Japan is going to be hosting the 2020 Olympics. This is going to be, of course, in Tokyo, not Fukushima. But does the Japanese government really fear that any kind of realistic assessment of the impacts of Fukushima will in turn have a bearing on, you know, their reputation as a host of the Olympics at the very least?
Well, hosting the Olympics was certainly a marketing ploy to take people's minds off of the disaster. You might recall that back in 2011, 2012, Prime Minister Abe was saying that the radiation was contained and everything was under control. And based on his assurances, the Olympic Committee gave Japan the Summer Olympics. But that was a marketing ploy. You know, if you just looked at, here's the New York Times and Reuters and on the anniversary of the accident, saying that this is not under control. So he said what he needed to say to get the Olympics, and I think they're hoping that people's minds will be taken off the disaster.
So, Arnie, let's talk about the lessons for the United States. Climate change, we know, is escalating. In fact, there was a new NASA report this week. I mean, we're seeing every indication that climate change is happening even faster than scientists predicted. What this, of course, does is it creates disruptive climate that makes existing nuclear reactors, even ones that may not be active, very vulnerable, even more vulnerable, just as the Fukushima Daiichi power plant was vulnerable to a tsunami. That aren't we going to be seeing or having greater likelihood of severe climate patterns risking our nuclear plants here in the United States?
Yeah, that's a great observation. You know, when engineers go back over the weather related records, they go back maybe 100 years and they say, well, the worst flood was, and the worst hurricane was, and the worst whatever the natural phenomenon was, is based on the last 100 years of data. But in the last 10 years, you can throw all that data out the window. There's a couple of plants that come to mind. The one in New Jersey, which is Hope Creek. Oyster Creek, rather. That's the one that Sandy hit. And they were within 6 inches of flooding the cooling pumps that they thought had been protected from a 1,000-year event. You know, so these 1,000-year events keep coming at a much more increased frequency than you'd ever expect. Another one's down in Florida. It's Turkey Point. It got hit by a tornado about a decade ago, and all of the offsite communications were lost for 3 months. So, yes, climate change is jeopardizing nuclear plants around the country and around the world.
And so what needs to happen now? Are people paying attention to the lessons from Fukushima, particularly given that the Japanese government is trying to downplay it so much? It seems as though, you know, when people like yourself are speaking out about what is really happening in Fukushima, you are often written off as a conspiracy theorist. You know, all the like the study that I mentioned, there have been so many studies sort of downplaying the impacts of Fukushima, so that people who are speaking up like yourself appear to be exaggerating.
You know, there's so much money on the other side of this argument. I think we have the people on one side and the moneyed interests on the other. The banks in Japan have been doling out billions and billions of dollars to keep the 50 nuclear plants that are still potentially viable, keep their employees on the payroll for 5 years. What business would do that unless they knew they were going to get their money back? You know, you wouldn't open a grocery store and then say, hey, guys, I'm going to pay you all for the next 5 years, even though we have no customers. Well, the Japanese banks are behind a lot of these issues, because they've given the money away, anticipating that sooner or later these plants are going to be start back up. Where did they get that promise from? They got that promise from the Japanese government. I think the inhumanity of the Japanese government toward its own people has just been appalling.
Well, where can people find out more information? Can you give out the website for the Fairwinds Energy Education Organization?
Yeah, thank you. It's Fairwinds, Fairewinds. It's the old English spelling. Fairwinds.org. And we have a great website. Something like 11 million people have visited it. And we are the go-to source in Japan as well.
Really?
For reliable information. We're the biggest website in Japan for reliable information.
And we'll post a link to that from uprisingwithsonali.com later today. Arnie, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
My guest is Arne Gunderson. He sits on the board of directors of Fairwinds Energy Education. He has more than 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience and has managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the United States. He just finished a one-month tour of Japan. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Our theme music is by Quetzal. You can like us at facebook.com/uprisingradio and follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. If you're a listener to our Southern California station KPFK and would like to listen to Uprising with Sonali 5 days a week, simply tune in to kpfa.org in the 8 to 9 a.m. hour and listen to the live stream. This program airs Mondays and Tuesdays on KPFK and Monday through Friday on KPFA. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host, audio engineer, and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.